From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a look at how housing can impact children's health and some ways of solving this complex issue.
I think more and more there are solutions. I think it sometimes feels like housing is this insurmountable problem, but I really truly believe that we can come together as communities to increase health through housing stability.
Later, what attracts scientist Mark Siddall to creepy things like leeches and parasites, and why we should care about them too.
We'll get a look at the latest production from Milwaukee Chamber Theater.
And Marcus Theater celebrates their third year of the Cine Latino Festival, now expanding beyond South Shore Cinema.
It's not just about growing the business, it's not just the business opportunity, it's about the connection with the community and being authentic and the recognition that goes along with that.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are many obstacles to health care in the United States. Many of these obstacles are financial, and there's a core issue that researchers and healthcare professionals have been focusing on recently, housing.
Housing instability and its health implications are a core part of Dr. Megan Sandel's work. Dr. Sandel is a professor of pediatrics and environmental health at Boston University. She's also a nationally recognized expert on housing and child health, who will share her expertise at Wauwatosa United Methodist Church tomorrow night.
Dr. Sandel spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone from Boston, and she starts by explaining some of the many ways that housing can impact a person's health.
I think that housing can impact health in four really important ways. First is housing quality, right? Is your home, clean and dry and doesn't have pests or other things? But also, is it sometimes filled with light and fresh air, and sometimes even being able to see greenery around your house are all parts of housing quality that either promote health or prevent adverse health. The second kind of dimension, or the second wall in how housing impacts health, is about stability, right? Are you not moving frequently? Are you not worried about being evicted? Are you able to feel confident that you're going to stay in your house and that it's kind of a safe place for you? The third part, honestly, is affordability. Are you straining to pay your rent or mortgage each month? Are you worried about it? Are you potentially at risk of becoming homeless because you can't afford where you're living? And then this kind of fourth dimension after kind of quality, stability, affordability is, where's your home location? Are you in a neighborhood that feels safe? Are you in a neighborhood where you can walk to a grocery store or to transportation options? And again, is there open space or greenery around you? All of those are really important aspects in how where you live can impact your health.
And have very clear connections to your health.
I think what's amazing is how much research is now coming out in all of these dimensions in how housing can impact health.
Yeah. You know, you work specifically with children, and a big part of your work is about the importance of housing for a child's health. How many children who are going in for medical care are homeless or facing housing instability?
Yeah, it's a great question. We recently studied this through a research policy network that I'm part of called Children's Health Watch. We interview families with young children, kids under 4 years of age, in five cities, in Baltimore, Philadelphia, Boston, Little Rock, and Minneapolis. And we interviewed these families with young children that were renters. And we were pretty shocked that a third of them were reporting to us that they had a form of housing instability, either that they were homeless or had a history of homelessness, or that they had moved at least twice in the past year, or they had fallen behind on rent at least once in the past year. So I think it's incredibly common, actually. I think it's much more common than people think. Recent studies suggest that 20 million families across the country spend more than 50% of their take-home income on rent. And so when we think about what's going on, I think this is a problem in every community.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing number there, one-third of families.
Yeah. And I think what's been interesting is we've started just actively screening for it. When you come in to a pediatric visit, we hand you a questionnaire called a Thrive questionnaire, and we ask you about your housing situation. Are you having trouble affording enough food? Do you have trouble paying for your heat or your light bill, transportation, and other things? And I think what's amazing about it is that we understand more and more that medical care is not enough for health, that your social determinants of health, like where you live and whether you have enough food or access to job, education, transportation, are more important to your overall health outcomes. And so you're going to hear more and more about health systems intervening in this space, because we recognize more and more that in order to be a health system, it can't just be about medical care. We have to take on all of the aspects of health in order to improve outcomes.
So when we're talking about children specifically, what are the health implications of, you know, housing instability?
Yeah, more and more housing instability can affect children's health in multiples of ways. First and foremost, it can affect, you know, your general health. Are you feeling well? Are you able to be active in your life? I think the second is in how you develop, right? Are you learning like what you're normally supposed to do, exploring your environment, being able to honestly sleep through the night and be able to grow like a normal child? And then obviously we know that education can be one of the strongest predictors of overall health. And we know that kids who move frequently are more likely to have difficulty in school, to actually maybe need to be retained a grade or to score lower on standardized tests. And that has huge implications on whether, again, you go to college, what type of career you have, what your lifetime earnings are, and ultimately, honestly, your mortality. We know that, you know, kids who move frequently are less likely to graduate from high school, and that's one of the strongest predictors of overall health.
Now, a big part of your work is solutions. So what are some of the solutions to this housing instability, to creating more affordable, I'm asking you a huge question, but creating more affordable housing and creating situations where kids can have better health outcomes?
Yeah, I think more and more there are solutions. I think it sometimes feels like housing is this insurmountable problem, but I really truly believe that we can come together as communities to increase health through housing stability. First and foremost, we need to prevent homelessness before it occurs. And so being able to actively ask people about their housing situations and to be able to prevent evictions and to be able to help families if they have, say, emergency costs that force them to fall behind on bills, intervene so they don't end up in homeless shelters, is incredibly important. I also think that we need to be investing in more affordable housing options for people across the income span, people who are both low income but also moderate income, and make housing affordability, even for home ownership, more available. We at Children's Health Watch investigated what did we think were the avoidable health costs related to unstable housing in children and families. We came up with a number of $111 billion over 10 years. And so while people talk about what the costs of making sure everyone have a stable home is, that implies we're not spending that money now. And we are. This is costing us billions of dollars of avoidable health costs because we aren't investing in that future. And then finally, I think that we should be creating more investment vehicles to build housing. So that can be where health systems or banks or other types of community institutions actually invest in affordable housing, trust funds, and others in order to build long-term affordable housing in communities as a resource to be able to have healthier communities overall.
Well, and to your point about, you know, the amount of money that we're currently spending to kind of wrap around these services, I'm sure you're familiar with Million Dollar Murray, a man who, you know, they studied, was homeless, chronically homeless, and just studied how much money they were spending to wrap services around homeless people more generally. And they found they were spending so much. It spurred a lot of Housing First initiatives, including one in the city of Milwaukee. What do you think of those initiatives?
Yeah, I think that more and more, when you really look at the root cause of a lot of high cost, high need patients like Million Dollar Murray, the root cause often is homelessness. We started looking at the hospital that I work at, Boston Medical Center. We looked at our top 2% of high utilizing patients, patients that cost us regularly more than $100,000 a year, and 40% of them were homeless or housing unstable. And what we found was even when we did these amazing complex care management programs, we really didn't move the dial unless we addressed their underlying housing instability and homelessness. And so I think that's where you're going to see health systems start to think both short-term and long-term. Are there ways in which we can partner with housing programs? I'm not saying that hospitals should become landlords and build their own housing, but we can invest in housing partnerships with public housing authorities and with other affordable housing community developers to create more affordable housing options. Honestly, if we just take a handful of really expensive patients and decrease their utilization, we may be able to pay for childcare in the community or other types of investments that may be more upstream that may be able to create healthier people of the future. I don't want to just focus on the high cost, high need patients, but I do think that we can start thinking about ways to bend the cost curve with them that may free up dollars that allow us to be focused more on prevention and to be able to focus more on families and children as housing stable options too.
Well, and that's a big part of this equation, right? Part of the reason that we do these housing first initiatives is so preventative care is more accessible. And so when people, you know, have a medical regimen that they are on, they can keep up with it as opposed to living in perhaps a homeless encampment where their belongings are often sifted through by perhaps other people or even the police, and they don't have the ability to keep up with these kinds of regimens.
Yeah, I think more and more you're going to see health systems really focused on what we call more upstream approaches. So when we talk about, you know, taking care of really sick patients and trying to help them with their chronic diseases or their mental illness, substance use disorders and others, that is an incredibly intensive intervention, and it's pretty far downstream from where they were at sometimes as young adults or as children. And so more and more, we are trying to not just focus on those kind of, you know, really, really sick patients, those kind of almost tertiary prevention programs, but then are we able to get to more secondary and primary prevention? Are we able to get more upstream? And there are ways in which we can do that both with individual patients, but also with communities, right? We mapped where most of our super utilizing patients lived, and they lived in 5 zip codes right around our hospital. And so that has been kind of spurring us as a hospital to create a housing initiative with $6.5 million in those 5 targeted zip codes as a way to create housing partnerships so we can invest in housing, not just for our high cost, high need patients, but also potentially for everyone who lives in the community. And therefore we can try and change the trajectory of their lives and be able to move more upstream.
Well, and do that from the moment they're children, right?
Yeah. And I think children, there's no better payoff than investing in young children, right? You know, that is where the long-term sustainability is. I think, unfortunately, a lot of times we ask models to show a short-term return on investment and can't take the long view. And I just think more and more we have to take a community-level approach where we think both short-term and long-term. We think about ways in which to create efficiencies now, but then reinvest those savings for that long-term approach. So we're not just constantly going downstream and being able to do all these emergency things. No, we need to do prevention so we don't have to do them in the future.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Megan Sandel, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to coming to Milwaukee in a couple of weeks, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Dr. Megan Sandel is a professor of pediatrics and environmental health at Boston University, as well as a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center. She was previously the pediatric medical director at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, and she's an expert on housing and child health.
She'll share her expertise in a conversation at Wauwatosa United Methodist Church tomorrow at 6. Dr. Sandel spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then meet a scientist for whom parasites and toxins are frequent topics of conversation. Mark Siddall joins us when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mark Siddall is a specialist in the kinds of things you probably hope stay the heck out of your house. Siddall is the curator of invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he specializes in things like leeches and parasites, and also in the field of poisons and toxicology.
But he will prove that even things we might think of as yucky or frightening can be fascinating as well when he gives the latest Science on Tap lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum Thursday. We reached him by phone in New York ahead of that visit. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
Happy to be here.
So I think a lot of us in the general society try to stay away from creepy crawly things, parasites, stuff like that when we can. What drew you to them?
As subject matter, it's kind of interesting that, I thought museums of natural history were the places where you put all the stuff that you couldn't put in a zoo because they were too dangerous, like venomous snakes and tarantulas and things like that. But I grew up in a small town in southern Ontario, Canada. We had a ravine across the road from the house. We used to go down there and play with stuff all the time. We used to go on canoe trips and camping trips. And so my experience with things like leeches is something that's very naturally acquired. I got interested in parasites when I was an undergraduate. I was given the opportunity. I ended up just sort of stumbling into a course on parasitology that was taught by a gentleman named Sherwin Besser. And it was, for someone like me who was interested in medicine, it was totally fascinating. Obviously, there's a lot of things like malaria parasites and worm parasites that you get exposed to. But it also opened up some knowledge of the natural world and how no species is really an island unto itself. That there's really a niche of organisms that makes up any individual thing, including humans. There's all kinds of parasites that are just unique to us. And so we can't really be well understood without also understanding the parasites that we harbor and the microbiome that makes us who we are as well.
Well, and at a certain point, after you've studied this for long enough, does it lose its shock quality or its grossness or the kinds of things that most of us attach to it?
I think the grossness, the revulsion, if you will, is something that's learned. And I've got kids of my own, and I do a lot of work on leeches. I like to say that I'm the curator of wormy, slimy stuff at the museum, whether it's leeches or squid or flatworms or what have you. And exposing my kids to those things, exposing is maybe not the right word, but, letting them play with those things as kids, they've got a natural affection for them. I myself had a revulsion, if you will, some trepidation around collecting leeches when I needed to do that for my graduate research when I first started, because I had been probably conditioned going on canoe trips and coming out of the water with a leech on me and not knowing of it. There's that sense of violation of something sucking your blood and you didn't even feel it. And then when you have a parent go, "Oh my God, you've got a leech," then you're being trained that this is a problem. And it's weird, right? Because like nobody does that with a mosquito, because you see the mosquito coming. So I think part of it is actually the not knowing it's coming kind of thing. And not knowing whether you're parasitized or not. That also applies to the issue of poison. Poison is fascinating to people because in terms of things like assassinations or in warfare or just walking through the woods, you don't know it. You don't see it. You don't see poison. You don't see venom until it's too late.
Well, and that's a perfect segue, because I know part of what you're talking about in this Science on Tap lecture touches on the history of toxins and poisons in cultural lore. What are some of the earliest examples of poisons showing up in literature or history more broadly?
Well, in fact, we're used to the word toxic or toxin or pharmaceutical, pharmacon. Interestingly enough, if you go back to Greek literature, a toxin or something that was toxic, the word actually comes from the yew tree. And yew trees were associated with making the bows for bow and arrows because they're really, really flexible. And so a toxin was a substance that was poisonous that you would put on something sharp, like an arrow or a spear or a sword or something like that. Whereas a pharmacon, from which we get the word pharmaceutical, actually was something that you would give as a poison that somebody would eat or drink, like Socrates drinking hemlock. That was a pharmacon. And so those words have come down from ancient Greek in two different ways.
Well, and do I gather that you kind of keep tabs on the use of venom and toxins and such in pop culture today?
I do my best. It goes through phases, interestingly enough. There was quite a bit around the time of the television show Breaking Bad, and even Dexter There was a character on Dexter who was poisoning people. That was also, you know, the Borgias was a television show that obviously related to the actual Borgias that were very famous for poisoning the people who were in the way of their power. So it waxes and wanes depending on what seems to be popular out there.
And there was also a time that poisons were fairly common weapons of war in say, the Cold War.
Well, certainly. And thankfully, they didn't actually get deployed as much as anybody may have feared. They were definitely deployed quite a bit during the First World War with mustard gases. So chemical warfare actually goes back a very long time. There's an incident that happened when the city of Hatra was under siege by the Romans, and the people in the city of Hatra had run out of things to throw at the Romans who were surrounding the city. What do you do when you've got nothing to throw? Well, they actually sent people out at nighttime to gather up as many scorpions as they could at night, put them in clay pots, and flung those clay pots during the daytime at the advancing Romans, and actually caused the Romans to retreat. That's biological warfare. It doesn't even matter if anybody got stung. They just have to be afraid, which is kind of the way that even a lot of modern weapons of mass destruction operate. It's more about the threat of using them to prevent somebody from coming at you than it is about using them themselves. They do, unfortunately, do get used periodically and to horrific effect.
I think about how journalism is sometimes depicted in movies and pop culture, and I think maybe it's generally gotten better, but as a scientist, can you simultaneously watch, you know, something like Breaking Bad or Dexter or a superhero or sci-fi film for its entertainment value while also deconstructing the science supposedly at work, or do you go straight into the, you know, this is preposterous mode?
You know, I'll be honest with you, it's really entertaining for a scientist when a writer or a producer, director, what have you, when they really get it right, because you're like, wow, yeah, they know it, they got it. Somebody spent the time to maybe talk to a scientist or do the research. And so in contrast, it's always sort of eye-rolling when they don't. The National Academy of Sciences has a program called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, in which they set up situations where writers and directors and producers can get together with scientists over beers or sort of scientific speed dating kind of thing, like they do it in New York and LA and so on, and specifically with the intent of improving the literacy of people who are writing things in Hollywood and or for other purposes. And I think it's doing a terrific job. We really actually, as scientists, do want to get out there and communicate our science and see it leveraged in entertaining ways. We're not always the best at communicating those ideas, but we're trying.
Well, okay, so if you were making a film, what is the overlooked poison you think really deserves a starring role?
Serotonin. I know. So serotonin is what's in your brain, and if you take something like Xanax or Prozac, it's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and so it's not really thought of as a poison. But if you inject that under somebody's skin, it's one of the most painful things out there. So you could use it to torture people. I don't think you should torture people, but we're talking about a movie here. It's, in fact, one of the major components in wasp things is serotonin. Huh. And that gets stuck under your skin, and it just drives the neurons wild. It's terrifically painful.
This is almost like a slightly more painful version of the Star Trek phaser on Stun.
Yeah, there you go. There's, you know, if you look at stories, it's amazing how many poisons have been used. A really good example is Agatha Christie. She used just about everything under the sun, from nicotine to strychnine to morphine and so on. I once had a really fun opportunity to go and sit with a group of women. It turns out they're called Sisters in Crime. They're a club of women who like to write crime stories and mystery stories, and they had me come and talk to them about new ways to off their characters in their stories.
Well, listen, Dr. Mark Siddall, fascinating conversation. I'm sure it will be a fascinating lecture as well. Thank you so much for making some time for us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm really looking forward to being in Wisconsin the next few days.
Mark Siddall is curator of invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He'll give the latest Science on Tap lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum Thursday evening. You can find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then the inside story of the latest production from Milwaukee Chamber Theater opening this week. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
Thank you.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. For students of the American Civil War, the story of Major General Benjamin Butler, later Congressman Butler, is an important one. A lawyer by training, Butler used his knowledge and skill in such a way that ultimately ended up changing the course of the war. But when he made the decision he did, it was in the very early days of the conflict. Butler had no idea how his unorthodox decision would be received by President Lincoln or whether he would even have his commission once word got out.
These events have been dramatized in a play called Ben Butler, which was written by our next guest, Richard Strand. It's part history, part battle of wits, and part comedy. We reached the playwright at his home in California to learn more about the play and how he came to write it.
I first learned of the incident because I was reading a Lincoln biography, and it was mentioned, footnote. It wasn't really even emphasized, but the idea of the incident seemed not understandable to me. So I started researching that incident more and more. I was really just trying to understand it. It was quite a bit later that it occurred to me that it might make a play.
When you did decide that it might make a good play, what was it about the incident and the characters that made you think this would make good drama? Not just an interesting story, but this would be fascinating on stage.
Well, yeah, I'm always looking for, do I have characters with objectives and do they encounter obstacles? That's how I construct a play if I'm doing it on a whole cloth. That's what I was looking for in this. I was frankly aided by the fact that not very much is known about the encounter that Butler had with Shepard Mallory, or indeed if they ever did have a one-on-one conversation with each other. There's some evidence that they did, but it's by no means clear-cut. And what was said in that one-on-one confrontation, that's not knowable. So that pitches it back to me that I can now make that up, and that makes it easier for me to construct it as a drama. They had similar objectives, and yet they were in great conflict with each other, and that's the sort of stuff that attracts me as a playwright.
Well, and what makes this so interesting is that you've distilled down the conflict that started the Civil War into basically three characters. There are three main characters, and it becomes very personal to us as we watch these people negotiate with each other. But also, you've somehow managed to take the entire Civil War and what was going on and why it happened and the conflicts that people were feeling on a macro level and make it so personal and funny. And those things, you know, you don't think of usually, most of us, you know, the Civil War is very serious, and it was a very awful time in our history.
I can tell you about the funny thing that it wasn't part of my thinking when I was writing the play. I wasn't trying to write a funny play. And nobody believes this, but I really never strove for the humor. It was a serious topic to me, and I was trying to approach it seriously. I was frankly a little surprised when audiences started laughing. I wasn't disappointed, and I understood why they were laughing. But let me say that it is a profoundly serious topic in my mind. And if I had thought that anybody would think that I was making light of the topic, I would not have done it. The humor comes from the fact that you've got men trying to defend what is not defendable. And that's just the irony of the situation. All of my plays incorporate humor, and I never try to put it there.
Well, maybe that's why they work, because you're not trying.
I think that's right. Let me say that when I have seen production where they try to emphasize humor or try to help the humor, I think that is always a mistake. It has two effects. It makes the play less serious, and it makes the play less funny.
And in this case, I mean, this is it's a dialogue-heavy play. There's not a lot of physical, it happens in one place, and there's not a lot of, I mean, people come on and off stage, but that's about it.
And of the people who come on and off stage, Butler isn't one.
Right, he's just there.
Right.
And so, you know, to make that kind of on the surface, you could say this is a very talky play because there isn't a lot of action. But the dialogue, to me, at least on reading it, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm looking forward to that. But the dialogue on the page acts as scene shifting and acts as that movement to me. Was that something you were thinking about as you were doing it, or is that just my interpretation of it?
No, that's absolutely what I'm thinking about. If a play is heavy in dialogue and plays often are, as opposed to action, the action is that the people change over the course of the play. And that's sort of the magic trick of good drama. We're in a space where we can see live human beings and we can watch them change in front of our eyes. We can watch them go from one emotional place to a vastly different emotional place. And if it's done right, then you don't even quite know when the change happened, but it sort of sneaks up on you. And that, yes, you bet, that's absolutely what I'm trying to achieve when I write.
That kind of change, most of us don't change on a dime usually. You know,
that is correct. And, change, in fact, for human beings is extremely difficult. And so if it's going to be a play, it wants to be about change, but it also has to incorporate this truism about people, which is that people don't change easily. And so at the end of the play, I think they are pointed in a direction, but Butler doesn't go as far as he does in his life in terms of changing his attitude. For people who know more about Butler and what happened to him as he became a congressman after the war, the change in him was profound. We see the beginnings of that in the play that I wrote.
Every character, the three major characters, do all change to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But it's never strained the bounds of believability. It's like they didn't, you know, they didn't go from A to Z in the course of the play. It's believable. Like, okay, they're arguing with each other and trying to make each other see their individual points of view. And like you say, we get to the end where they're pointing in a similar direction. And we don't know in the life of the play, we don't know where that's going to end up.
That's right. In fact, as far as the characters are aware, it's going to go someplace very differently than it in fact ended up going. Butler has every reason to think at the end of the play that he's going to lose his commission, that President Lincoln will be displeased by what he did. And we don't know precisely how President Lincoln felt about what he did, but he punted on the issue. Butler did not lose his commission and, in fact, was encouraged to continue in the direction that he had chosen to go.
One of the things I love is the interplay between Butler and Kelly, the lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is because I have a military background and I know what that interaction mm-hmm. can be. And I think you've captured it so beautifully.
It pleases me to hear you say that.
Yeah, that to me is extremely funny. And anyone who has any military background will recognize that. Even if they weren't an officer, they will recognize that interplay between the lesser rank and the greater rank and how that negotiation happens. And I find that fascinating too. And it allows the lieutenant to have an ability to change as well.
There is an opening scene that, in my experience, is enjoyed more by people who have military experience.
This play has been produced quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Are you surprised at its popularity? It is, as you say, an incredibly serious subject.
I'm becoming, you know, increasingly less surprised as it gets done more and more. But I will tell you that when I was writing it, I told my wife several times, nobody's going to do this play. I wanted to finish writing it. I liked the play, but I thought for a number of reasons that it wasn't going to get produced. My agent wasn't oh so excited when I told him I wrote a Civil War play. So I thought for that reason it wouldn't get produced. In a lot of ways, I think that the structuring of the play is old-fashioned. It doesn't have a lot of theatricalism in a more modern sense. It reminds me in some ways of a 1950s play or a 1960s play. And so I'm writing the play. I like what I'm doing, but I always thought there's just nobody who's going to do this play. And I was frankly quite surprised when New Jersey Rep called very soon after I sent it to them and told me that they wanted to do it.
Well, I think you're right. I think that 50s or 60s, you know, I thought of Arthur Miller. You know, I thought of that kind of it's almost a domestic drama. The way it's set
exactly
up.
Exactly right, yes.
Yeah, that it's in that one room and, you know, people come and go and all of it's happening right there. And if you know theatrical history at all, American theatrical history, that was very common in whether Tennessee Williams or, you know, Arthur Miller or those folks. And, yeah, you're right. It doesn't have the overt theatricality that a lot of more modern things do, but it does. At, you know, it's kind of at its heart. You said it earlier, we're watching people go through conflict and changing, and we're being told a story. And to me, that is the ultimate theatricalness, if that is the way to put it. And maybe that's why.
To me as well. It is the thing that I look for. The thing that I enjoy the most in watching a play is an extended two-person scene where they start off one place and they end up in a different place. That's theatrical magic in my mind.
We reached playwright Richard Strand at his home in California. Ben Butler is receiving its Milwaukee premiere this week at Milwaukee Chamber Theater. You can find out more about the production at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then a preview of this year's Cine Latino series, which comes your way when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee has its fair share of film festivals, but often the foreign language film is a category within a larger festival, with Spanish and other language films presented together. For the third year in a row, though, Marcus Theater's Cine Latino Festival will dedicate its screens to diverse Spanish language format films from Mexico to Paraguay and elsewhere.
Cine Latino features 15 films at three Marcus Theater's locations. The festival begins today and runs through the 14th and includes a new mobile filmmaker contest called Next Gen Cine.
To talk about the festival's growth and the new field of mobile filmmaking, Marcus Theater's field marketing manager Juan Valenzuela and local filmmaker Marcelo Martinez joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio. Valenzuela began by explaining why Cine Latino has expanded its reach beyond South Shore Cinema in Oak Creek.
The Latino community doesn't just exist in Milwaukee. The Latino community in Waukesha is thriving, and the Latino community in Racine is thriving. And we're just very fortunate to have locations that can actually serve those audiences out there who we felt are underserved when it comes to cinema. And so we feel there's an opportunity to make an introductory step, and Cine Latino is the perfect vehicle for us to use to do that, we feel. And we're hoping that we can make a long-lasting impact in those communities. And maybe there are folks out there who normally don't go to our theater, and this would be a great opportunity for them to check us out, and hopefully we can wow them and invite them back.
What was your biggest lesson so far in running this program as you've learned to now expand it? And, mm-hmm. and what kind of challenges are you anticipating for yourself with this year?
While there is an audience, it's still a niche audience. But it's becoming more and more mainstream because there's a lot of crossover and you've got different levels of acculturation. And so the language is definitely something that we're still working on the right formula. Dubbed movies, subtitled movies, original Spanish language movies. There's a mix of those you'll see in this slate of Cine Latinos, that we have a really good mix for those folks who are bilingual, for those folks who only speak Spanish, and for those folks who don't speak Spanish, they can come and watch a Spanish language movie with subtitles.
And it really is that kind of equalizing factor, you know, going to the movies. It's something that everyone wants to enjoy. So what kind of feedback have you heard from years past of, say, people maybe from Racine who came down to Oak Creek to come and watch these movies?
When can we get ours? So the more we hear that, it reminds us that we're going in the right direction and we're taking the right steps. And feedback is super important for us. And hearing it come from future guests is something that we hope to continue.
Now, a portion of all the proceeds for Cine Latino benefit local Hispanic health and education efforts. So could you go into what adversely affects Wisconsin's Latino communities in the areas of health and education?
This is a pretty broad topic. And our partnership with Aurora is really important to us because there is a Spanish-speaking community, and we are specifically partnering with our first night for our Noche de Energia. 100% of those proceeds are going to benefit the cancer clinic that is a Spanish-speaking cancer clinic. And Dr. Federico Sanchez, who runs that clinic, it was very important for him to be able to communicate very tough news in a language that is native for those who are Spanish speaking. And so we're very proud to be able to support that clinic in particular. And we rely a lot on Aurora to provide us with, you know, where they are going to focus the funds. And we know that everything is going right back locally.
And when it comes to programming the lineup for the festival, as you just mentioned, I mean, obviously it's a more serious topic of being delivered bad medical news in your local language. But the important factor of going somewhere in a public space that has your local language available for you. So what are you looking for in Spanish language films that you are accumulating for the lineup year after year?
We like to act local but think global. So globally, there are really great movie makers, not just in the United States, Central America, South America, even the Iberoamericanos is what they're called, from the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal and places like that. But we have a couple selections this year. A few in particular, we have Las Herederas, which is a Paraguayan movie. It's in Spanish. It was submitted for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Did not win, obviously, but something that we felt, this is a wonderful movie based on the story of two women and their struggles and overcoming those struggles. And it's from South America. We have two South American films, actually. So we have Las Herederas and then we have El Ángel, which is from Argentina. And that movie is based on true events that occurred during the 1970s in Argentina. So for those folks who aren't too familiar with the political climate and how they were and how things were in the 70s in South America, you'll learn a lot. In both movies, actually, you'll learn a lot. And it's great that we can bring these types of happenings for people who aren't familiar, you know, because sometimes we can tend just to focus on Mexico and realize that there is a whole other continent south of that with a whole lot of culture and a lot to offer and a lot to share. And we're just happy that we can take a little piece of it. But the vetting process is not easy. We actually invite influencers from the community, from the local Hispanic community, to provide us with feedback. We play trailers for this specialized group, and they provided us with feedback on what they thought would make an impact and what they think, you know, would be a good movie to show. So we do have a great partnership in that sense with the local community to help us with making our decisions, because it's not easy.
Right. And I'm curious, are you hearing any feedback from the people who are distributing these films?
You know, it depends, because there are challenges to getting movies imported. Myself, I've been with Marcus for just under 2 years, and I'm still learning about the film business. And I've learned through Cine Latino that there are barriers. It's not as simple as going to Amazon and ordering a DVD. Sometimes you need to go through consulates, and it requires effort and it requires investment. There is money that's required to make sure that things can get through. And in this digital world, you would think that it was really simple to just push a button and send the file through. And in some cases, it can be that way, but in some cases, it can be very challenging. So we do hear from the distributors, and they are excited when they do hear from us. I've been on email chains from the very beginning where it's like, oh, this is great news. Thank you for selecting us. And we're just as excited because now we have a new partner. And so we can have new content. And the whole key here is to continue having content, good content.
Exactly. And Marcela, you can jump in on this next one too. But as you mentioned before, Juan, it's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to foreign language filmmaking, Spanish language filmmaking, et cetera. But obviously, Roma this past year got a lot of attention at the Academy Awards. So do you see that as possibly carrying some momentum to get more people from an outside audience interested in seeing foreign language film?
I think in that sense, yes. In that sense, it is. It was good for exposure to our language, to the Spanish language in that sense. And so it's good to see that. It just means and I'm sure Marcelo will jump in here, accessibility is everything now. More people than ever have access to make content and make really good content. And feel free.
Well, actually, specifically with Roma, I think people have more accessibility to, like, art house films, right? So that was available on Netflix, and it had a lot of buzz, and everybody had the chance to watch it versus having to go there to the theater and watch it. So that's what was really great about that film. And it also had a lot of exposure with the indigenous community. I think that's what's the most powerful thing about that film was centering an Indigenous woman. And I think what that does, it just maybe it makes people more comfortable to tell their story, because that's kind of an unheard voice. It encourages people to tell their story. And that actually kind of goes into the accessibility of filmmaking.
Yeah, because you're leading the Next Gen Cine Mobile Filmmaker Contest, and that goes into the whole concept of, you know, we don't need a crew and an expensive camera and all these things to make a quality video. So what's your goal in leading this effort?
For one, when I was a kid, I didn't grow up with a cell phone. I mean, I did, but it was a flip phone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like the Razr before that even. But just iPhones have great cameras, you know, and they have great sound recording devices and mobile editing. I mean, you literally have everything in your hand. It's a powerhouse. And you can make it look great. And that's kind of the point of this workshop is what we're doing in this workshop is teaching pretty much the basics of filmmaking, all right? Splitting it up into four groups. Editing, lighting, sound design, and videography. And that's all available on your phone and with natural daylight. So what the point of this workshop is using what you have and also kind of about how restriction can make you more creative. All right, so you may not have like the best lights. You may not have a really nice camera. You might not have a really good audio system. But using what you have in your hand and then just figuring out how to optimize it can really help you push in that direction. So that's what we're going to be doing, just like very basic things, you know, basics of videography, you know, the settings that you can manipulate on your phone, tricks to get good audio on your phone, how to manipulate light or household lighting that you have to make something look good. So that's pretty much what the point of this workshop is, just showing you everything that you can do with your phone without having to buy anything.
Yeah. And of course, you're passionate about the subject. Otherwise, you know, why would you lead such a thing? But I'm curious, what brought you into filmmaking in the first place? And what do you like to focus your work on or draw inspiration from?
Well, I got into filmmaking pretty much since I was a kid. I used to make movies on little camcorders at my cousin's house. They're terrible, but, you know, they're they're fun. That's the point. But I grew up watching films, and I feel like they cultured me and exposed me to different points of views. The thing is, like, I never really saw myself in films.
And, right. When was the first time you saw a Spanish language film that you recall?
You know, I grew up watching them, but I remember the one that really grabbed me, speaking of Roma, was an Alfonso Cuarón movie, Y Tu Mamá También. I think I was like 11 or 12 years old when I saw that. But it kind of showed me the beauty of Mexico and the beauty of being Mexican. And I feel like that really got me into imagery and cinematography. And I feel like that's what kind of clicked in my head, the art of filmmaking. I can be really dramatic in real life, right? So like anything that happens in my life, any kind of life milestone, anything that happens, I'll take it and I'll think about it like, oh, that would be kind of like a cool scene in a movie. You know what I mean? I think they call it dramaturgy, where you kind of view, you're kind of like on stage all the time. I tend to think like that. When I'm sitting somewhere, I always kind of think like, what would be a good shot in here? How could we make this space look interesting? And that's kind of the point of this program too. Like you can have a blank room and it could be really boring, but you can make it really exciting through different angles, through storytelling, through acting, through directing, through everything. And you don't need much to do it. You just need everything in your head. You just need to be creative.
With being a multidisciplinary filmmaker, what do you wish someone would have taught you when you were self-teaching yourself or even going to school here locally? You know, one key lesson that you're going to be sure to be passing on to this Next Gen Cine Filmmaker series.
Don't be afraid of failure. Just keep trying. Just keep making films. Even if they come out and you don't want anybody to see them, you made something and that's something you can be proud of. Failure is actually the most important thing that can happen.
With Cine Latino, you know, just in its third year, but obviously it's getting great momentum and it's supplying a need that the community is expressing. But yet, of course, it's happening, well, and we could argue that all 3 years it's been happening during a time of dissonant public rhetoric, the anti-immigrant rhetoric. So overall, what do you see the greatest importance of Cine Latino accomplishing with each festival that it curates?
I think recognition is extremely important, and just recognizing that the Latino communities in Wisconsin and in Southeast Wisconsin is just a small percentage of the potential audience. We are fortunate to have a footprint that continues to grow at Marcus. We feel that this continues to be a really important part of, it's not just about growing the business, it's not just the business opportunity, it's about the connection with the community and being authentic and the recognition that goes along with that. And there's a message to everything, and recognition is something that we want to continue to do, is recognize our community and really support it in that way.
And Marcella, what does it mean for you to lead the Next Gen Cine Mobile Filmmaker Contest and then also just simply to be a part of this festival?
Yeah, absolutely. I do kind of want to go back a little bit and say that I think one of the more important things about this festival and about the accessibility of filmmaking is that everybody does have a voice. And like we were just talking about, I'm first generation Mexican, I'm queer, and I've never really seen myself on screen, or I've never seen anything that reflects my identity. So a lot of the work I do deals with that. And it doesn't have to be serious. Like, I've made comedy, I've made horror, I've made documentary, I've done drama, you know, I've try my hand in everything. I think the whole point of it is it's important to not depend on other people to tell your story. It's important for you to tell your own story. And everybody does have that ability with their phone. And that's what makes me really excited about leading this. I think a lot of the people that are going to be at this workshop are going to be kids of color. And I think it's important for them to see that what they have to say and what their experience is valid and important. So it's really important to me doing this, because this is something I wish I had when I was younger, to be encouraged to tell my own story and to have the ability to, if I was to win, have it shown in movie theaters. That's one of the prizes, actually, for the Next Gen Cine. This contest is really great because I feel like it's an equal playing field. A lot of times when there's a lot of movie contests, people with the better equipment, they're going to make a piece that looks better, that sounds better, that looks more professional. Here it's an equal playing ground. Everybody's using the same camera, the same audio equipment. And I think it really... what it does, it focuses more on the content than on the way it's delivered. And I think that's why this contest is really unprecedented and really important, especially to the Wisconsin, Northern Illinois area.
All right. Well, Marcella Martinez and Juan Valenzuela, thank you both so much for coming in today to talk about Cine Latino. And I wish you the best of luck with the contest and with the festival.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate being here.
Juan Valenzuela is the field marketing manager for Marcus Theaters, and Marcelo Martinez is a local filmmaker who'll lead the Cine Latino's Next Gen Cine workshop. The festival begins today, and it runs through April 14th at Marcus Theaters in Oak Creek, Sturtevant, and Brookfield. You can find out more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tying. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.